Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. In 1921, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote about the Ku Klux Klan, quote, "Recently, there has been an attempt to revive this organization as a protest against colored people and Catholics and Jews. The effort is both annoying and funny," end quote. If the description sounds a little simple or geared toward a kid, that was the point. The quote comes from The Brownies Book, a periodical founded by Du Bois in 1919 and written specifically for black children, meant to feature real news told in kid-friendly ways and encourage its readers to love themselves and their blackness through images and stories. Anna Holmes, writer and creative director of the Obama's production company, Higher Ground, writes about The Brownies Book in an essay for The Atlantic's new initiative, Inheritance. In his editor's note, Jeffrey Goldberg described the project as a, quote, "way to fill in the blank pages of black history." For example, highlighting the work of the influential but underrecognized abolitionist Charlotte Fortin, who became the first black woman to write for The Atlantic in 1864. The magazine's ongoing effort will feature stories from Atlantic contributors about slavery, civil rights, lesser-known corners of history, and personal memory. Anna Holmes joins me now to discuss her contribution. Anna, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So obviously, Du Bois is a well-known writer and thinker and activist. You don't normally connect him to children's literature. How did he get involved in writing for kids and why?
I would say more that he created a magazine that he happened to have some of his writing in than he was writing for kids. Mm-hmm. But how he came to it was, you know, he was the editor of The Crisis, which was the kind of house organ magazine for the NAACP. And every year they'd have what they called the children's number. It was not an issue of the magazine that was totally devoted to children, but had content for children in it. What he found to be a bit disturbing and frustrating was that he assumed that American children, particularly black American children, were looking at the regular issues of the crisis just by dint of the fact that they were in their own houses, especially, you know, obviously with regards to their parents being members of the NAACP. And he was concerned that the stories in the crisis were either frightening young children in terms of their depictions and reports about racist violence, and perhaps making them hate white people. I don't know that maybe that's the right way to put it, but he was concerned that depictions of racial violence were kind of infecting young black children in ways that was both scary and alienating. And also there was, you know, the children's number issues of the crisis were some of the most popular issues. So he and his literary editor, a woman named Jessie Fawcett, decided to kind of spin off the children's number into its own children's magazine, which they called The Brownies Book. And The Brownies was a reference not to the youngest Girl Scouts, which is what people think of nowadays, but to the readers of their magazine, to young children of color.
There's a sense that part of the goal of the magazine was, in one way, to let kids be kids, but acknowledging the reality for black children, which had to include discussions about safety and self-preservation. Du Bois wrote of these two goals side by side. He wrote, "to point out the best amusements and joys and worthwhile things in life, and to inspire them to prepare for definite occupations and duties with a broad spirit of sacrifice." So what did both of these goals, pointing out amusements and also preparing for occupations and what life will look like, how did that work in practice in the actual magazine?
Well, in terms of the, you know, pointing out the best amusements and joys and worthwhile things, I'd say that those were represented in the magazine in the form of plays, you know, literal pieces of dramatic writing, games, fairy tales and other pieces of fiction that were either wholly original or were being interpreted and rewritten. by contributors. In terms of, you know, preparing them for occupations and duties, you know, Du Bois felt very strongly that the plight of Black Americans and the eventual kind of sloughing off of the limitations imposed on them was going to happen through, you know, the education of the masses of Black Americans, and that not just the education, but the entry into professional occupations. So in terms of reflecting that and inspiring kids, each issue had at least one kind of short portrait of a portrait biography of a well-known person. Some of these were really at the time considered more historical figures like Sojourner Truth or Phyllis Wheatley. Some were more contemporary, at least for that time, like Frederick Douglass. And in doing so, he and the other editors were, you know, looking to inspire Black children to greatness and to give them examples of Black greatness, which they were not really exposed to, certainly not in curriculum in schools. And I'd argue that that continued well into the into the 20th century and even the 21st. But there was also a column that was written by Jessie Fawcett, in which she played a quote unquote kind of judge, and she would address the readers of the magazine, the children of the magazine, with advice on not just things like comportment, which sounds a little Victorian, but their duties as citizens, as American citizens, to strive for greatness and to lift up their quote unquote race.
Yeah, she's an interesting person, by the way. Jessie Redmond Fawcett, she graduated from Cornell in 1905. She taught at Dunbar High School in Washington, D.C. She earned her master's degree in French from UPenn in 1919. She studied at Sorbonne. It's extraordinary for a woman, extraordinary for a Black woman, given the time. How do we see her and her life in this magazine?
Well, that's one of that was one of my frustrations, I think, in what I saw in the magazine, which is that she is obviously the driving force of the magazine. Mm-hmm. I mean, W.E.B. Du Bois had a lot of other things to be doing besides, you know, serving as role as editor in chief of the Brownies book. It was really her magazine. And I'm not sure that she's gotten credit, or at least was getting credit for for the work that she was doing. I mean, I really do believe it may have been his vision, but she was the one who was continuing to articulating it and making it happen. You know, she was a great champion of a number of writers who came to become renowned in for their work in the Harlem Renaissance, including Langston Hughes. Langston Hughes wrote in to the Brownies book as a teenager. I believe he was probably about 16 or 17. There was a section in the magazine that was basically letters to the editor from children. There was also one, a letters to the editor section from parents and adults, but the children one, he wrote in and was sharing news of his accomplishments, including being named class poet.
That's and, so funny.
You know, here's a teenage Langston Hughes. And within a couple of issues, he obviously had sent in, submission to Jessie Fawcett, a poem that she decided to publish. And so this was actually the first place that Langston Hughes was published, was in the Brownies book. And there were a number of, over the months, because it was a magazine that only lasted 2 years, poems. He had a report from Mexico. He'd been traveling in Mexico, and he was, I would say it was kind of personal essay / report. He had a couple of games he created that they published. But yeah, this was his debut, so to speak.
My guest is Anna Holmes. We're talking about a piece that she contributed to for the Atlantic's Heritage Inheritance Project. It's called The Magazine That Helped 1920 Kids Navigate Racism. So the magazine, from your reporting, you write that lasted about 2 years and had about a readership of 5,000. Who made up the magazine's readership, and where did kids find it? Where did they come from?
The magazines were being, you know, there were, as you said, about 5,000 subscriptions. They were being sent to the households that had subscribed to them. And, you know, these were households primarily that were already politicized, for lack of a better word. They were, the readers were primarily the children of members of the NAACP. So there was, I wouldn't say it was self-selecting, but there was, as I said, there was already a kind of politicization to the readership. There were attempts, multiple attempts in the magazine. You'll see this both towards the beginning of each issue and the end, to try to expand the number of readers, which the crisis slash Brownies book had a really hard time doing. I mean, part of the reason that it had to cease publication was because they were just not able to cover their expenses. They needed about 12,000 subscribers, and as you said, they had about 5,000. But you would see in these kind of ads, both in the beginning of each issue and at the end, attempts to get readers to tell their friends, you know, to grow the circulation of the magazine. And, you know, I'm not exactly sure why it was so difficult. The Brownies book was an incredibly unique contribution to, you know, American periodicals at the time. One would think, or would hope, that it would have inspired a lot more attention than it got. And I can't really say why it didn't. It's hard for me to determine why that is. One of the saddest things is that it did end publication after 24 issues. It was, its first one was January 1920, and the last issue was December of 1921.
The magazine included photography, pictures of cute babies, sketches and images of successful adult African-American historical figures. One cover of a little girl, just almost looks like she's just dancing freely. If you go down the Google rabbit hole, you can find these pictures. I think it's from Library of Congress has some of the pictures.
Yes.
Why was the visual element of the magazine so important?
This was what really struck me the most. For all the kind of interesting stories and columns, including one that Du Bois did himself called Where the Crow Flies, it was his way of informing readers as to what was going on in the world, both internationally and domestically. And in fact, the quote that you read from at the beginning of the segment about the KKK appeared in that section. Mm-hmm. The thing that was really the most striking were the images, and not even actually so much the covers, although the cover you just mentioned of the girl, she seems to be doing ballet, is really kind of whimsical and beautiful. But the fact that there was a repetition and a celebration of Black childhood on almost every page of this magazine, over and over and over again, in which Black children were depicted as being the children that they are, which is to say, not that different from white children. And it was white childhood that was being centered in American culture and within American children's literature. So you would see photos of kids at camp playing. There was, as you mentioned, a section of just portraits of younger Black children, by which I mean, you know, babies and toddlers, usually, you know, seated in a portrait studio, mm-hmm. smiling at the camera. Portraits of high school graduates. The Brownies book editors made really, really, really concerted attempts to try and find out the names and locations of every Black high school graduate in the country, which is, you know, an enormous undertaking. And I can't say that they always found all of them. But the repetition of these pictures and the ways in which they depicted Black childhood as normal and celebratory and joyful really was the most striking part of the magazine to me. It told the story of a people that wasn't being told in at least mainstream magazines, and particularly not in other children's magazines. One of the most famous children's magazines at the time was called St. Nicholas, and its depictions of Black people, if it depicted them at all, were as kind of, you know, as pickaninnies, as poorly dressed caricatures. You know, people with exaggerated features. I mean, just racist caricatures. So there was a normalization of Black childhood using imagery that I think actually might be the most powerful element, or was the most powerful element of that magazine, which is not to, you know, denigrate the other sections, but just the sustained embrace of images. And you know, this was in the decades before Life magazine became such a powerhouse. I do think that people respond to images of depictions of American life in this way that they might not have responded to text.
And our last minute, was there any pushback on the magazine?
Not that I'm aware of. I'm not aware of any pushback on the magazine or towards the magazine with regards to the Black community. I'm not aware of any pushback with regards to the white community. In fact, I'm not sure that there were that many white Americans who were even aware of its existence. There's one thing I mentioned towards the end of the piece, and this is what only suggests to me that white Americans were not aware of it. A young girl.
Let's get about 30 seconds, Anna.
Okay, sorry. A teenage girl wrote in to talk about how five of her high school graduates, white graduates, had refused to sit next to her at her high school graduation. And one of the things that the Brownies book did was publish the names of those five white kids. So that suggests to me that white Americans were not reading the magazine.
There you go. Anna Holmes, thanks for being my guest.
Thank you so much.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.